Phaedrus, a dialogue of Socrates with Phaedrus.
My dear Phaedrus, where are you off to and where have you come from?
From Lysias, Socrates, Cephalus's son, I'm going for a walk outside the wall. I spent a long time there sitting since early morning. On the advice of your friend and mine, Acumenes, I take my walks on the roads. He says they're less tiring than the ones in the running tracks.
Good advice, my friend. So Lysias was in the city, it seems.
Yes, at Epicrates' house, the one near the temple of Olympian Zeus, Mauritius's old house.
So what were you doing there? Or is it obvious Lysias was treating you to a feast of speeches?
You'll hear if you have the leisure to walk along and listen.
What? Don't you think I'd consider hearing your conversation with Lysias, to quote Pindar, a business more pressing than business itself?
Lead on, then.
Speak away.
Well, Socrates, it's really a fitting thing for you to hear. The speech we were occupied with was, in some strange way, about love. Lysias has written up an attempt at seduction aimed at some good-looking young man, but not from the position of a lover. That's actually the clever twist. He argues that one should grant favors to a man who isn't in love rather than to one who is.
What a noble fellow. I wish he'd write that one should favor the poor man over the rich, the older man over the younger, and all the other things that apply to me and most of us. Then his speeches would really be charming and useful to the public. As it is, I'm so eager to hear it that even if you made your walk all the way to Megara, and following Herodicus's method, touched the wall there and came straight back, I wouldn't fall behind you.
What are you saying, my excellent Socrates? Do you think that I, a mere amateur, could reproduce from memory, in a way worthy of the man, what Lysias, the cleverest writer alive today, composed over a long stretch of leisure? Far from it, though I'd rather have been able to than come into a great deal of money.
Phaedrus, if I don't know Phaedrus, I've forgotten myself as well. But neither of those is the case. I know perfectly well that when he was listening to a speech of Lysias, he didn't just hear it once. He kept asking him to repeat it, again and again, and Lysias obliged eagerly. But even that wasn't enough for him. In the end, he got hold of the book itself and pored over the parts he wanted most. Doing just this, sitting from early morning, he wore himself out and went off for a walk already, I'd wager by the dog, having the speech memorized by heart, unless it was extraordinarily long. And he was heading outside the wall to practice it. Then he ran into a man sick with a passion for hearing speeches. And seeing him, yes, seeing him, he was delighted because now he'd have someone to share his frenzy with, and he urged him to lead on. But when the lover of speeches begged him to recite it, he played coy, as if he had no desire to speak, though in the end he was going to tell it by force even if no one wanted to listen willingly. So, Phaedrus, ask him to do now what he'll shortly do anyway.
It really is by far my best course to speak it as best I can, since you seem quite unwilling to let me go until I say something, one way or another.
You have exactly the right impression of me.
Then here's what I'll do. Truly, Socrates, I did not learn the actual wording by heart, but I can go through the gist of nearly all the points by which he claimed the position of the non-lover differs from that of the lover, one by one in order, starting from the first.
Only after you show me, dear friend, what you're holding under your cloak in your left hand, I suspect you have the speech itself. If that's so, think of me this way. I'm very fond of you, but with Lysias himself present too, I'm not at all inclined to let you use me for practice. Come now, show it.
Stop, you've knocked out from under me the hope I had of using you as my training partner, Socrates. Well, where do you want us to sit down and read?
Let's turn off here and go along the Ilissus, and then sit down wherever seems good, in some quiet spot.
It's lucky, it seems, that I happen to be barefoot today. You always are, of course. It'll be easiest for us to walk in the little stream, wetting our feet, and not unpleasant either, especially at this time of year and this time of day.
Lead on, then, and look at the same time for where we might sit.
Do you see that very tall plane tree?
Of course.
There's shade there, and a moderate breeze, and grass to sit on, or lie down on if we'd rather.
Lead the way, then.
Tell me, Socrates, isn't it from somewhere around here, along the Ilissus, that Boreas is said to have carried off Orithyia?
So it's said.
Was it from right here, then? The water looks lovely and clear and transparent, and just right for girls to be playing beside it.
No, it's about 2 or 3 stadia downstream, where we cross over toward the sanctuary of Agra. There's an altar of Boreas somewhere there, I believe.
I hadn't quite noticed that, but tell me, Socrates, in God's name, do you actually believe this myth is true?
Well, if I disbelieved it, as the clever folk do, I wouldn't be so out of step, and then I could go on being clever and say that a gust of Boreas pushed her off the nearby rocks while she was playing with Pharmacia, and that's how she came to die and got the story of being snatched by Boreas, or else that she was carried off from the Areopagus, since that version is told too, that she was seized from there rather than from here. For my part, Phaedrus, I find such things charming enough in their way, but they're the business of a man who's altogether too clever and hardworking and none too fortunate. For no other reason than that after this, he'll have to go on to straighten out the shape of the Hippocentaurs, and then the Chimera, and there'll come pouring in after that a whole crowd of things like Gorgons and Pegasuses and other impossible swarms and oddities of monstrous natures. If someone doesn't believe in these and wants to reduce each of them to something plausible, using a kind of rustic cleverness, he'll need a great deal of spare time. I myself have no spare time at all for such things. And the reason, my friend, is this. I'm not yet able, as the Delphic inscription demands, to know myself. So it seems ridiculous to me, while I'm still ignorant of that, to go investigating things that don't concern me. That's why I let all that go, and simply accept the common view about such stories, as I just said, and I examine not those things but myself, whether I happen to be some beast more twisted and more puffed up with passion than Typhon, or a gentler and simpler creature, sharing by nature in some divine and unassuming lot. But wait, my friend, in the middle of all this, wasn't this the tree you were leading us to?
This is the very one.
By Hera, what a lovely resting place. This plane tree is wonderfully spreading and tall, and the height and shade of the chaste tree are quite beautiful, and it's at the very peak of its bloom, so it fills the whole place with fragrance. And then there's this spring, flowing most charmingly under the plane tree, with very cold water, my foot can testify to that. And judging by the figurines and statues, it looks like a shrine sacred to some nymphs and to Aeacus. And if you like, notice how welcome and how very pleasant the breeziness of the place is. It has a summery, clear ring to it, answering the chorus of cicadas. And the most exquisite thing of all is the grass, growing thick enough on this gentle slope that one can lay one's head down most comfortably. You've guided us here beautifully, dear Phaedrus.
And you, amazing man, seem the strangest of creatures. Honestly, the way you talk, you seem exactly like some stranger being shown around by a guide, not a local at all, so much so that you never seem to leave the city for the country beyond, or even go outside the wall, as far as I can tell.
Forgive me, my excellent friend, I'm a lover of learning, and the countryside and the trees are unwilling to teach me anything, whereas the people in the city are. But you seem to have found the charm that will draw me out. Just as people lead a hungry animal along by dangling a branch or some fruit in front of it, so you, by holding speeches out to me in books, seem set to lead me around the whole of Attica and wherever else you please. So now, since we've arrived here, I intend to lie down, and you should choose whatever position you think will let you read most comfortably and read away.
Listen, then. You know my situation, and you've heard how I think it would benefit us both if this came about. I don't think it's right that I should fail to get what I'm asking simply because I don't happen to be in love with you. Lovers, after all, come to regret the good they've done once their desire has subsided. But for the others, there's no point at which it becomes fitting for them to change their minds. For it isn't under compulsion, but by choice, having reasoned out as well as possible about their own interests, that they act well within their means. Moreover, lovers look at what they've mismanaged in their own affairs on account of their love, and what they've done well, and adding in the trouble they've had, they think they've long since paid back the gratitude they owe their beloveds in full. But those who aren't in love can't offer neglect of their own affairs as an excuse on this account, nor can they count in past troubles, nor blame quarrels with their relations, so that, with so many bad things stripped away, nothing is left for them except to act eagerly on whatever they think will please. Further, if lovers deserve to be prized highly because they say they love their beloveds most of all, and are ready, both in word and deed, to please them at the cost of making everyone else hate them, it's easy to see that, if they're telling the truth, then whoever they fall in love with later, they'll value more than the present one, and clearly, if that new one wishes it, they'll mistreat the present one too. And yet how reasonable is it to hand over something so precious to a man suffering from a condition like that, one which no experienced person would even attempt to cure? Indeed, they themselves admit that they're sick rather than in their right minds, and that they know they're thinking badly but can't control themselves. So how, once they came to their senses, could they think well of decisions made while in such a state? And besides, if you were to choose the best from among your lovers, your choice would be from a small pool. But if you chose the one most suited to you from everyone else, it would be from a great many. So there's a far better chance, among the many, of finding one worthy of your friendship. Now, if you're afraid of the established custom, worried that people finding out will bring you disgrace, consider this. It's the lovers, thinking that others will envy them just as they envy themselves, who are likely to be puffed up by talking about it, and out of vanity to show off to everyone that their trouble hasn't been for nothing, whereas those who aren't in love, being masters of themselves, choose what's genuinely best over reputation among men. Furthermore, lovers are bound to be noticed and seen by many people trailing after their beloveds, making a business of it, so that whenever they're seen talking to each other, people assume their passion has been, or is about to be, satisfied. But no one even thinks to blame those who aren't in love for spending time together, since they know that talking with someone is bound to happen either through friendship or through some other pleasure. And further, if you're gripped by the fear that friendship is hard to maintain, and that while in other kinds of falling out, the misfortune would fall on you both alike, once you've given up what you value most, the harm would fall on you especially, then it would make sense to fear lovers more rather than less. For they are troubled by many things, and they think everything that happens is directed at their own harm. That's exactly why they discourage their beloveds from spending time with anyone else, fearing that men of wealth will outdo them with money, and men of education will surpass them in intelligence, and they're on guard against the power of anyone else who has some other good quality. So by persuading you to become estranged from these people, they leave you friendless and isolated. Whereas, if you look to your own advantage and show more sense than they do, you'll come into conflict with them. But those who were never in love, but achieved what they wanted through their own merit, wouldn't be jealous of the people you spend time with. Rather, they would hate those unwilling to associate with you, thinking themselves looked down upon by them, but benefited by those who do keep company with you. So that there's a far better chance that friendship, rather than enmity, will come of the whole affair with them. PHADRUS. And what's more, many lovers desired the body before they knew the character or became familiar with the rest of what belongs to the beloved, so that it's unclear to them whether they'll still want to be friends once their desire has stopped. But with those who aren't in love, who were already friends with each other before they did this, it's not likely that the good they receive from it will make their friendship smaller. Rather, those acts are left behind as reminders of what's still to come. And besides, it's fitting for you to become better by listening to me than by listening to a lover. Lovers praise what you say and do even when it goes against what's best, partly out of fear of becoming hateful to you, partly because their own judgment is worse for it, on account of their desire. That's the kind of thing love shows. When lovers are unlucky, it makes them think painful things that don't trouble anyone else. When they're lucky, it forces them to heap praise even on things not worth any pleasure at all, so that the beloved really ought to pity them far more than envy them. But if you're persuaded by me, first of all, I won't be spending time with you in service of the pleasure of the moment, but of the benefit that's going to come, since I'm not overpowered by desire but master of myself, and I won't take up a strong hatred over small things, but will build only a little anger, slowly, over great ones. I'll forgive what's involuntary and try to turn you away from what's done on purpose. These are the proofs of a friendship that's going to last a long time. But if it has occurred to you that a strong friendship can't come about unless someone happens to be in love, you should bear in mind that then we wouldn't value our sons very highly, nor our fathers and mothers, and we wouldn't have trustworthy friends either, since none of those relationships arise from that kind of desire, but from other pursuits entirely. Further, if we ought to do favors above all for those who need them most, then in other matters too, it's fitting to help not the best people, but the neediest, since freed from the greatest troubles, they'll feel the greatest gratitude toward us. And indeed, even at our own private feasts, it's not our friends we should be inviting, but beggars and those who need a good meal, for they're the ones who'll be fond of us and follow us around and come to our doors and take the greatest pleasure in it and feel no small gratitude and pray many good things down on us. PHADRUS, but perhaps it's not fitting to do favors for those who need them most desperately, but for those most able to return the favor, not merely to beggars, but to those worthy of the thing itself. Not to those who will merely enjoy your youthful bloom, but to those who, once you've grown older, will share their own good things with you. Not to those who, once they've had their way, will go boasting to others, but to those who out of modesty will keep silent before everyone. Not to those whose devotion lasts only a short while, but to those who will remain friends alike through the whole of life. Not to those who, once their desire stops, will go looking for a pretext to quarrel, but to those who, once the bloom of youth has stopped, will then display their own worth. So you should remember what's been said, and also keep this in mind, that friends admonish lovers as though what they're doing were something bad, while none of a person's own family has ever blamed those who aren't in love, as though on that account they were making bad decisions about themselves. Perhaps then you'd ask me whether I'm advising you to grant your favors to all who aren't in love. Well, I think not even the lover himself would tell you to hold this attitude toward all lovers, since that wouldn't earn the recipient equal gratitude, nor would it let you keep the matter as hidden from everyone else as you'd wish, and there should be no harm coming from it, but benefit to both. So I, for my part, think what's been said is enough, but if there's something more you're longing for, thinking it's been left out, ask. What do you think of the speech, Socrates? Isn't it extraordinary, both in general and especially in its wording? Socrates, divinely so, my friend, so much that it stunned me. And I felt this way because of you, Phaedrus, watching your face, because you seemed to me to be glowing with delight over the speech as you read it. So thinking you understood these matters better than I do, I followed your lead, and following, I fell into a Bacchic frenzy along with you over that inspired head of yours. PHADRUS, well now. Is that how you want to joke about it? Socrates, do you think I'm joking and not being serious? PHADRUS, not at all, Socrates, but truly, in the name of Zeus, god of friendship, tell me. Do you think any other Greek could say things greater and more numerous than these on the very same subject? Socrates, what then? Must the speech be praised by both you and me on this ground too, that the poet said what needed to be said, and not only on that other ground, that the phrases are clear and rounded, and each word turned precisely on the lathe? For if that's required, I'll grant it for your sake, since it escaped me, given my own worthlessness. I was paying attention only to its rhetorical side, and I wouldn't have thought even Lysias himself would consider that part adequate. And it seemed to me, Phaedrus, unless you say otherwise, that he said the same things two or three times over, as if he weren't very resourceful at saying many things on the same subject, or perhaps he simply didn't care about that sort of thing. He struck me as showing off, like a young man flaunting his ability to say the same things in different ways, and to say both versions excellently. Phaedrus, nonsense, Socrates, that's exactly what the speech has going for it above all. Of everything worth saying that belongs to the subject, he's left nothing out, so that beyond what he said, no one could ever manage to say anything else, more in quantity or more valuable. Socrates, that much I won't be able to grant you any longer. Ancient wise men and women who have spoken and written about these things will refute me if I concede that to please you. Phaedrus, who are these people? Where have you heard anything better than this? Socrates, I can't say just now off the top of my head, but clearly I've heard it from someone, perhaps from lovely Sappho, or from wise Anacreon, or even from some prose writers. What makes me infer this? My chest feels somehow full, my good man, and I sense that I could say other things, no worse than these, in addition. Now I know well enough that none of it has occurred to me on my own. I'm well aware of my own ignorance, so what's left, I think, is that I've been filled up, like a jar, from some outside springs, by way of hearing, though out of dullness I've forgotten this very thing too, how, and from whom, I heard it. Phaedrus, well, my noblest friend, that's the finest thing you could have said. As for whom and how you heard it, don't tell me even if I ask you to, just do exactly what you say. Promise to say things better than what's in that book, and no fewer, keeping clear of what's written there, and I, like the nine archons, will promise to set up a golden statue, life-sized, at Delphi, not just of myself, but of you too. Socrates, you're a dear, and truly golden, Phaedrus, if you think I mean that Lysias has failed entirely, and that it's possible to say altogether different things in place of everything he said. I don't think even the most mediocre writer could avoid that fate. Take the very subject of the speech. Whom do you imagine arguing that one should grant favors to the man who isn't in love rather than to the one who is, could leave out praising the good sense of the one and blaming the folly of the other, since these points are simply unavoidable, and then have something else, something different, to say? No, I think such points must be allowed and forgiven the speaker, and in cases like this, it's not the invention but the arrangement that deserves praise, while for points that aren't unavoidable and are hard to invent, the invention deserves praise along with the arrangement. Phaedrus, I grant what you say, that seems to me a fair statement. So I'll do the same. I'll grant you as a premise that the lover is more afflicted than the one who isn't in love. But on all the rest, if you say other things, more numerous and more valuable than these of Lysias, then stand forged in bronze beside the offering of the Sipsilids at Olympia. Socrates, are you taking it seriously, Phaedrus, just because I teased you a little by grabbing hold of your darling? Do you really think I'm going to try to say something more elaborate than his cleverness? Phaedrus, on that point, my friend, you've fallen into the very same trap yourself. You must speak as best you're able, in whatever way you can, so we won't be forced into that vulgar business of the comic poets, trading one thing for another, so be careful, and don't make me say that line, if I, Socrates, don't know Socrates, and I've forgotten myself, and that you wanted to speak but were being coy. Just make up your mind that we're not leaving this spot until you say what you claimed to have in your chest. We're alone here in a deserted place, and I'm stronger and younger, so from all this, understand what I'm telling you, and don't make me force it out of you rather than have you speak willingly. Socrates, but my blessed Phaedrus, I'll look ridiculous, an amateur improvising on the spot next to a fine poet on the very same subject. Phaedrus, you know how it is. Stop putting on airs with me. I have something, I think, that will force you to speak. Socrates, then whatever it is, don't say it. Phaedrus, no, I'm going to say it right now, and my words will be an oath. I swear to you, by whom though? Which god? Or would you like it to be this plain tree here? I swear that if you don't deliver your speech facing this very tree, I will never again show you or report to you any speech by anyone, ever. Socrates, you scoundrel, how well you've found the way to force a lover of speeches to do whatever you tell him. Phaedrus, then why are you twisting and turning? Socrates, no reason anymore, now that you've sworn to that. How could I possibly hold back from such a feast? Phaedrus, speak then. Socrates, do you know what I'm going to do? Phaedrus, about what? Socrates, I'll speak with my head covered, so that I can race through the speech as fast as possible, and not lose my way from shame by looking at you. Phaedrus, just speak, do whatever else you like. Socrates, come then, muses, whether it's from the quality of your song that you're called clear-voiced, or from the musical race of the Lygians that you got this name, join me in this tale, which this excellent fellow here is forcing me to tell, so that his companion, who already seemed wise to him before, may now seem even more so. There was once then a boy, or rather a young man just past boyhood, very beautiful, and he had a great many lovers. One of them was crafty, and though he was in love no less than the others, he had persuaded the boy that he wasn't in love. And once, in asking for his favor, he tried to convince him of this very point, that one ought to grant favors to the man who isn't in love rather than to the one who is, and he spoke like this: about everything, boy, there is one starting point for those who mean to deliberate well. They must know what the deliberation is about, or they're bound to miss the mark entirely. Most people fail to notice that they don't know the true nature of each thing. So assuming they do know, they don't come to an agreement about it at the outset of their inquiry, and as they go on they pay the natural price. They don't agree, either with themselves or with each other. So let's not fall into the very fault we criticize in others, you and I. Since the question before you and me is which one we should turn to for friendship, the lover or the one who isn't in love, let's set down, by agreement, a definition of what love is and what power it has, and keeping our eyes on that, referring our inquiry back to it, let's examine whether it brings benefit or harm. Now that love is a kind of desire, is plain to everyone, and we also know that even those who aren't in love desire what is beautiful. How then shall we distinguish the lover from the one who isn't? We must further recognize that within each of us there are two ruling and guiding forces which we follow wherever they lead, one being an innate desire for pleasures, the other an acquired judgment that reaches for what is best. These two forces within us are sometimes in agreement and sometimes at war with each other, and at one time the one prevails, at another time the other.
Now when judgment leads us toward the best by reason, and that reason rule prevails, we call the prevailing power moderation. But when desire drags us without reason toward pleasures and gets the upper hand within us, that misrule is called excess. Excess goes by many names, it has many limbs and many parts, and whichever of its forms happens to stand out gives the person who has it a name drawn from that very form, and it is not a fine or worthy name to carry. If in the matter of eating it overpowers the best judgment along with the other desires, the desire is called gluttony, and the one who has it is called by that same name. If it seizes tyrannical rule over drinking and drags its possessor that way, It's obvious what title that will earn. And all the other names, kin to these and to their kindred desires, plainly belong to whichever desire happens to be ruling at the time. Now the reason all this has been said is probably clear enough already, but a thing said outright is always clearer than a thing left implied. When desire, without reason, straining toward what's right, overpowers judgment and is drawn toward the pleasure of beauty, and is driven on with full force by its kindred desires toward bodily beauty, and wins the contest by that driving from that very force, taking its name, it is called Eros, passionate love. But tell me, dear Phaedrus, do you think, as I do of myself, that I've been struck by something divine?
Very much so, Socrates. Some unaccustomed fluency has taken hold of you.
Then listen to me in silence. This place really does seem to be sacred, so if I fall into a kind of nymph possession as the speech goes on, don't be surprised right now I'm not far from breaking into dithyram.
That is absolutely true.
And you are the cause of it. But hear the rest, perhaps whatever's coming can still be turned aside. That will be the gods' concern. Our business is to go back to the boy with our argument. Well then, my fine friend, what it is we must deliberate about has been stated and defined. Keeping our eyes on it, let's go on to say what benefit or harm will naturally come to the one who grants his favors, from a lover as against one who does not love. For a person ruled by desire and enslaved to pleasure will necessarily want to make his beloved as pleasant to himself as possible. Now to a sick mind, everything that doesn't resist is pleasant, while anything stronger or equal is hateful. So a lover will never willingly put up with a boy who is stronger than him or his equal. He always works to make him weaker and lesser. And the ignorant is weaker than the wise, the coward than the brave man, the poor speaker than the skilled one, the slow-witted than the sharp. Given how many evils of mind like these, and even more necessarily arise in the beloved, or are already present by nature, the lover must either take pleasure in them or arrange to bring them about, or else be deprived of his immediate pleasure. And he must be jealous, keeping the boy away from many other kinds of company that would benefit him and make him truly a man, from which comes great harm, greatest of all from whatever would make him wisest. And that, of course, is philosophy, the divine pursuit from that above all. A lover must keep his beloved at a distance, terrified of being despised for it. He'll scheme in every other way, too, to keep the boy ignorant of everything and looking to the lover for everything, so that he'll be as pleasing as possible to the lover and as harmful as possible to himself. So as far as the mind goes, a man possessed by love is in no way a useful guardian or companion. Now we must look at the condition and care of the body that such a man, forced to chase pleasure ahead of good, will provide once he has control of it. You'll see him chasing something soft and not sturdy, not raised in the open sun but in mixed shade, unpracticed in manly toils and honest sweat but well practiced in a soft, unmanly way of living, decked out in borrowed colors and ornaments for lack of his own, and pursuing all the other habits that go with these obvious enough, not worth spelling out further. Let's just fix the main point and move on. Such a body, in war and in other great crises, gives confidence to enemies and fear to friends, even to the lovers themselves. This much we can leave as obvious. What comes next must be said, what benefit or what harm the lover's company and guardianship will bring us where property is concerned. This much is clear to everyone, but especially to the lover himself. He would wish, above all, that the boy he loves be stripped of everything dearest, most loyal, and most sacred to him. He would gladly see him deprived of father, mother, relatives, and friends, thinking of them as obstacles and critics standing in the way of the sweetest possible time together. And if the boy has a fortune in gold or any other property, the lover will not think him so easy to catch, nor, once caught, so easy to manage. So it's inevitable that a lover resents his beloved for having property and is glad when it's lost. What's more, a lover would wish his beloved to stay as long as possible unmarried, childless, and without a household of his own, wanting to enjoy what's sweet to him for as long as he can. Now there are other evils too, but some divine power has mixed a bit of immediate pleasure into most of them. A flatterer, for instance, is a terrible creature and a great harm, yet nature has mixed in some pleasure that isn't without its charm. And someone might fault a courtesan as harmful, and many other creatures and practices of that sort. Yet for the time being they manage to be quite pleasant day to day. But a lover, on top of being harmful to his boy, is also the most disagreeable company to spend one's days with. As the old saying goes, like delights like, for I suppose equality in age leads to equal pleasures, and through likeness produces friendship, yet even the company of equals in age can grow tiresome. And besides, whatever is compulsory is said to be burdensome to everyone in every case, and that, on top of the unlikeness between them, is exactly the lover's relation to his beloved. For an older man attached to a younger one will not willingly leave his side, day or night, but is driven by compulsion and by a kind of goad, which is always giving him pleasures seeing, hearing, touching, and perceiving his beloved by every sense so that he serves him gladly and eagerly. But what comfort or what pleasures can the lover give the boy in return, to keep him, over that same span of time, from reaching the very limit of distaste seeing an older face no longer in its prime, and all that goes with it, which is unpleasant even to hear described in words, let alone to have to deal with in fact under constant compulsion, being watched over with suspicious jealousy at all times and before everyone, hearing praises that are ill-timed and excessive, and just as much blame that is unbearable when the lover is sober, and when he's drunk, on top of being unbearable, downright shameful, delivered with an unrestrained and unguarded frankness. And while he's in love, he's harmful and unpleasant, but once his passion has passed, he becomes untrustworthy for all the time after the very time in which, with many promises backed by oaths and pleas, he barely managed to hold the boy to bear with a relationship that was already burdensome, for the sake of hopes of future good. And now, when the debt falls due, he has changed a different ruler, and master has taken over inside him, sense and moderation in place of love and madness. And he has become another person without the boy noticing it. The boy asks him for the gratitude owed for what came before, reminding him of what was done and said, as if speaking to the same man. But the lover, out of shame, doesn't dare say he has become someone else, nor can he find a way to make good the oaths and promises made under his former foolish rule. Now that he has come to his senses and regained self-control for fear, that by doing the same things as before he'll become like his former self all over again. So he turns and runs from all this, and the former lover, now forced into default, changes into a fugitive as the coin flips, while the boy is left to chase him in outrage, calling on the gods, never having understood from the start that he should never have granted his favors to a lover, someone necessarily without reason. But far rather to a man who does not love and has full possession of his senses. Otherwise he's bound to hand himself over to someone faithless, difficult, jealous, disagreeable, harmful to his property, harmful to the condition of his body, and by far most harmful to the training of his soul, than which nothing is or ever will be held in higher honor, truly, by gods or men. These are the things you must consider, my boy, and know that a lover's friendship comes with no goodwill at all. But the way one takes food for the sake of being filled up, as wolves love a lamb, so lovers love a boy. That's the whole of it, Phaedrus. You won't hear another word from me. Let the speech end right here.
And yet I thought it was only halfway through, and that you'd say just as much about the man who doesn't love, listing all the good things on his side. Why stop now, Socrates?
Didn't you notice, my dear fellow, that I'm already speaking in verse and no longer in dithyrambs, and this while finding fault? If I start praising the other kind of man, what do you imagine will happen to me? Don't you know that the nymphs, to whom you deliberately exposed me, will plainly carry me away? So let me just say in one sentence, whatever faults we've heaped on the one type, the opposite goods belong to the other. And what need is there for a long speech? Enough has been said about both. And so the myth will get exactly what's coming to it, and it will suffer just that. As for me, I'm crossing this river and going on my way before you force something bigger out of me.
Not yet, Socrates, not before the heat passes. Don't you see it's nearly noon now, the hour they call the still hour? Let's wait and talk over what's been said meanwhile, and go on once it cools off.
When it comes to speeches, Phaedrus, you are simply divine, altogether astonishing. Of all the speeches produced in your lifetime, I don't think anyone has caused more of them to come into being than you, whether by speaking yourself or by compelling others to speak in one way or another. I exempt Simmias of Thebes from this. The rest you far outdo. And now again you seem to have been the cause of a speech being drawn out of me.
That's no declaration of war, but how so, and what speech do you mean?
Just as I was about to cross the river, my good man, that divine sign, the one I'm used to, came to me. It always holds me back from whatever I'm about to do, and I thought I heard a voice right there, which won't let me leave before I purify myself, as though I had committed some offense against the divine. Now I am a kind of seer, though not a very accomplished one like people who are poor at reading and writing, just barely good enough for my own use. So I already understand clearly what my offense was. The soul, my friend, does have a kind of prophetic power. Something troubled me even a while back as I was giving that speech, and I felt a certain uneasiness, as Ibicus puts it, in case I might be buying honor among men at the price of some fault against the gods. But now I've perceived my offense.
What do you mean?
A terrible speech, Phaedrus, terrible one you yourself brought here, and one you forced me to deliver.
How so?
A foolish speech, and somewhat impious besides. What could be more terrible than that?
Nothing, if what you say is true.
Well then, don't you think Eros is a god, the child of Aphrodite?
So it is said, certainly.
Not by Lysias, though, nor by that speech of yours, which was spoken through my mouth after you had bewitched it. But if love is a god, or something divine, and he is, then he can't be anything bad. Yet the two speeches just given treated him as if he were. That's where they went wrong about love. And there's something else, a kind of silly cleverness in them too, to preen and posture as if they were saying something sound and true, when really they were saying nothing of the kind, hoping only to hoodwink a few simple young men and win a reputation among them. So I, my friend, must purify myself. There's an old rite of purification for those who go wrong in telling stories about the gods, one that Homer never learned, but Stesichorus did. When he lost his sight for slandering Helen, he didn't stay ignorant of the reason the way Homer did. Being a man of the Muses, he understood the cause, and he wrote at once, "That story is not true. You never sailed in the well-benched ships. You never reached the towers of Troy." And having composed the whole of what's called his palinode, his sight came back to him immediately. Now, in this one respect, I intend to be wiser than they were. Before I suffer anything for slandering love, I'll try to pay him back with a recantation, bareheaded this time, not veiled in shame as I was before.
Nothing you could say, Socrates, would please me more.
And you see, my good Phaedrus, how shameless both speeches were, this one and the one read from the book. Suppose one of us happened to be a person of noble and gentle character, in love with someone of the same sort, or once in love that way. And he heard people saying that lovers turn savage hatreds out of small grievances, and treat their beloveds with jealousy and harm. Don't you think he'd feel he was listening to men raised among sailors, who had never once seen a free and noble love, and that he'd be nowhere near agreeing with what we said against love?
Very likely, Socrates, by Zeus.
Well, out of shame before that man, and out of fear of love himself, I want to wash the bitter taste of that speech from my ears with something wholesome. And I advise Lysias, too, to write as soon as possible that one should favor a lover over a non-lover, other things being equal.
You can be sure it will happen that way. Once you've spoken your praise of the lover, Lysias is bound to be forced by me to write another speech on the same subject.
That I believe, so long as you remain who you are.
Speak then, and don't hold back.
Where's that boy I was speaking to before? He should hear this too, so he doesn't rush ahead and grant his favors to the non-lover before he's heard it.
He's right here beside you, always close by, whenever you want him.
Consider it this way then, fair boy. The earlier speech was spoken by Phaedrus, son of Pythocles, of Myrhinus, but the one I'm about to give belongs to Stesichorus, son of Euphemus, of Hymra. It must go like this. That story is not true which says that when a lover is present, one should favor the non-lover instead, on the grounds that the lover is mad and the other sound of mind. If madness were simply and purely an evil, that would be well said, but as it is, the greatest of our blessings come to us through madness, when it's given as a gift from the gods. The prophetess at Delphi and the priestesses at Dodona, when out of their minds, have done Greece a world of good, both for individuals and for the whole city, but sober, they've done little or nothing. And if we spoke of the Sibyl and all the others who, seized by prophetic inspiration, have foretold the future rightly to many people many times, we'd only be stretching out something obvious to everyone. But here's something worth citing as evidence. Those who gave things their names long ago didn't consider madness something shameful or disgraceful. Otherwise, they wouldn't have woven this very word into the name of the noblest of arts, the art that judges the future, calling it the Manichae, the mad art. No, they gave it that name believing madness to be a fine thing, when it comes by divine dispensation. It's only the people of today who, tastelessly inserting a T, have called it Manichae. Even the inquiry the clear-headed make into the future, using birds and other signs, since it draws on human reasoning to supply understanding and information, they called Oianisticae, the art of thought which people nowadays, dressing it up with a long O, call Oianisticae. So, in the same measure that prophecy, in name and in achievement, is more complete and more honored than augury. In that same measure, the ancients testify that God-sent madness is nobler than the self-possession that comes from men. And what's more, when the worst diseases and hardships have beset certain families because of some ancient blood guilt, madness has appeared among them and spoken in prophecy, finding the relief they needed by taking refuge in prayers and rites to the gods, and through purifications and sacred ceremonies, it has rendered the afflicted person free from harm, for the present and for time to come, discovering a release for the one truly mad and possessed from the evils that beset him. A third kind is possession and madness from the muses. Taking hold of a tender, untouched soul, it rouses it and drives it into bacchic frenzy in songs and the rest of poetry. And by adorning countless deeds of the past, it educates those who come after. But whoever comes to the doors of poetry without this madness from the muses, persuaded that skill alone will make him a competent poet, will find himself incomplete, and his poetry, the poetry of the sane man, will be eclipsed by the poetry of the mad. So many are the fine achievements of God-given madness I can tell you of, and more besides. So let's not be frightened by this point alone, and let's not let anyone unsettle us by warning that we ought to choose the level-headed friend over the one stirred by passion. Let him show this much more too, before he can claim the prize. That love is not sent by the gods for the benefit of lover and beloved. We, for our part, must show the opposite, that this kind of madness is given by the gods for our greatest good fortune. Our proof will be one the clever won't believe, but the wise will. So first we must grasp the truth about the nature of the soul, divine and human both, by looking at what it undergoes and what it does. Here is the starting point of the proof. Every soul is immortal. For whatever is always in motion is immortal, while whatever moves something else and is moved by something else, since it has an end to its motion, has an end to its life as well. Only that which moves itself, since it never abandons itself, never stops moving, and it's the very source and spring of motion for everything else that moves. Now a source has no beginning. For everything that comes to be must come to be from a source, but the source itself must come from nothing, for if a source came to be from something, it would no longer be a source. And since it has no beginning, it must also be indestructible. For if a source were destroyed, it could never come to be again from anything, nor could anything else come to be from it, given that all things must come to be from a source. So the source of motion is that which moves itself, and this can neither be destroyed nor come to be, or else the whole heaven and everything that comes to be would collapse and come to a stop, and would never again have anything to set them in motion and bring them back into being. Now that what moves itself has been shown to be immortal, no one need be ashamed to say that this very thing is the essence and the defining principle of the soul. Every body that is moved from outside itself is soulless, but a body moved from within, from itself, is ensouled, since this is the nature of soul. And if that's the case, if nothing else is what moves itself except soul, then soul must, of necessity, be something that never came to be and can never be destroyed. So much, then, for the soul's immortality. As for its form, this must be said. To describe what it actually is would take a long, altogether godlike account, but to say what it resembles is a shorter human task, so let's put it that way. Let it resemble the combined power of a winged team of horses and their charioteer. Now, the gods have horses and charioteers that are all good and of good stock, while everyone else's are mixed. In our case, first the driver controls a pair, and of his two horses one is fine and good and of fine stock, while the other is the opposite, bred from the opposite, so that our driving is necessarily a difficult and troublesome business. Now we must try to say how a living being came to be called mortal, and how another came to be called immortal. Soul in its entirety has charge of all that is soulless, and it patrols the whole heaven, appearing now in one form, now in another. When it is complete and fully winged, it travels the heights and governs the whole world in its course, but a soul that has shed its wings is carried along until it fastens onto something solid, where it settles and takes on an earthly body, which, seeming to move itself by the soul's power, is called, as a whole, a living being, soul and body fastened together, and takes the name mortal. The name immortal, though, isn't backed by any reasoned account. We simply picture a god, without ever having seen one or understood one well enough, as some immortal living thing having both soul and body, joined together for all time. But let these matters stand and be said however is pleasing to God. What we must grasp is the reason souls shed their wings and lose them. It's something like this. It's the nature of a wing's power to lift what is heavy and carry it aloft to where the race of gods dwells. And of all the things connected with the body, the wing has the greatest share in what is divine. And the divine is beautiful, wise, good, and everything of that kind. It's on these that the soul's plumage is nourished and grows, most of all, while by what is ugly and bad and their opposites it wastes away and is destroyed. Now Zeus, the great leader in heaven, drives a winged chariot and goes first, setting all things in order and taking care of them. He is followed by an army of gods and lesser spirits, arranged in 11 divisions, for Hestia alone remains behind in the house of the gods, while all the rest, ranked among the number of the 12, lead their divisions in the order each was assigned. Within the heavens there are many blessed sights and courses to be seen, which the happy race of gods traverses, each of them doing his own work, followed by whoever wishes and is able, for envy has no place in the divine chorus. But whenever they go to feast and banquet, they travel steeply upward to the high vault beneath the heavens, where the chariots of the gods, evenly balanced and easy to guide, move along without effort. But the rest struggle, for the horse that shares in wickedness weighs its chariot down, dragging and pulling toward the earth whichever driver has not trained it well. And there the soul faces its hardest and most extreme struggle. For the souls called immortal, once they reach the summit, go outside and take their stand on the outer rim of heaven, and as they stand there, the revolution carries them around, while they gaze upon what lies outside the heavens. Of that region beyond the heavens no poet here below has ever sung, nor will any sing worthily. But it is like this, for one must dare to speak the truth, especially when speaking about truth itself. It is a place occupied by being that truly is, without color, without shape, and untouchable, visible only to the intellect, the soul's pilot, the region about which the class of true knowledge is concerned. Since the mind of God is nourished by intelligence and pure knowledge, as is the mind of every soul that is concerned to receive what is proper to it, such a soul rejoices at last in seeing what truly is, and gazing upon truth it is nourished and thrives, until the revolution carries it around again to the same point. In the course of that circuit it beholds justice itself, it beholds self-control, it beholds knowledge, not the kind that is bound up with coming into being, nor the kind that varies from one existing thing we now call real to another, but the knowledge that resides in that which truly is, in the fullest sense. And having in the same way beheld all the other things that truly are, and feasted upon them, it sinks back down again inside the heavens and returns home. And when it has returned, the charioteer brings the horses to a stop at the manger and sets ambrosia before them, and gives them nectar to drink besides. That, then, is the life of the gods. As for the other souls, one follows a god most closely and comes to resemble it, and so lifts the head of its charioteer up into the outer place, and is carried around with the revolution, though buffeted by its horses and barely able to see the things that truly are. Another rises at one moment and sinks at another, and because its horses fight it, it sees some things and misses others. And all the rest, straining to keep up with what is above but unable to manage it, are swept along beneath the rim, trampling and colliding with one another as each tries to get ahead of the next. So there is turmoil and rivalry and the sweat of utmost effort, in which many souls are lamed through the incompetence of their drivers, and many have feathers broken in the crush, and all of them, after great toil, go away without having achieved the sight of what truly is. And once they go away, they feed on the food of mere opinion. The reason for this great eagerness to see where the plain of truth lies is that the pasture suited to the best part of the soul comes from that meadow, and it is on this that the wing's nature, which lifts the soul, is nourished. And this is a decree of necessity. Whatever soul becomes a follower of a god and catches sight of any of the truths, it remains free from harm until the next circuit, and if it can always do this, it always remains unhurt. But when a soul fails to keep up and does not see, and through some misfortune becomes filled with forgetfulness and wrongdoing and grows heavy, and being weighted down it sheds its feathers and falls to earth, Then it is the law that this soul shall not, in its first birth, be planted into any animal nature. But the one that saw the most shall go into the seed of a man who will become a lover of wisdom, or a lover of beauty, or someone devoted to the muses and to love. The second into a lawful king or a warlike and commanding man. The third into a statesman or a household manager or a man of business. The fourth into someone devoted to hard exertion, a trainer of the body or a healer of it. The fifth will have the life of a prophet or someone connected with mystery rites. To the sixth, a poet or some other imitative artist will be fitting. The seventh, a craftsman or a farmer. The eighth, a sophist or a flatterer of crowds. The ninth, a tyrant. In all of these, whoever lives justly gets a better lot afterward, and whoever lives unjustly, a worse one. For no soul returns to the place from which it came in less than 10,000 years, since it does not regrow its wings before that much time has passed, except the soul of one who has pursued wisdom without deceit, or has loved a boy together with the pursuit of wisdom. These souls, if they choose this life three times running, at the third thousand-year cycle grow their wings and depart in the 3,000th year. But the rest, when they finish their first life, come to judgment, and once judged, some go to places of punishment beneath the earth and pay the penalty there, while others are lifted by justice to some place in the heavens and live in a manner worthy of the life they led in human form. At the 1,000th year, both groups arrive to draw lots and choose their second life, and each chooses whichever it wishes. There a human soul may even pass into the life of a beast, and one who was once a man may return from a beast into a man again. For a soul that has never seen the truth cannot take on this human shape. A human being must grasp what is spoken of according to its form, moving from many perceptions and gathering them by reasoning into one. And this process is a recollection of those things our soul once saw when it journeyed with a god, looking down on the things we now say exist and rising up into what truly is. For this reason, the mind of the philosopher alone rightly grows wings, since so far as it can, it always keeps its memory fixed on those things, on which fixing his attention makes a god divine. A man who makes right use of such reminders, forever being initiated into perfect mysteries, alone becomes truly perfect. But because he stands apart from human concerns and turns toward the divine, the many admonish him as though he were out of his mind, not realizing that he is possessed by a god. This, then, is the whole point of everything said here about the fourth kind of madness, that which comes upon someone who, seeing beauty here on earth, is reminded of true beauty, and grows wings and struggles to fly upward but cannot, and like a bird gazes upward while neglecting the things below, and so is thought to be afflicted with madness. The point is that of all forms of divine possession, this one is the best and comes from the best sources, both for the one who has it and for the one who shares in it. And that a person touched by this madness is called a lover of beauty.